Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. I am Regina Austin, William A. Schneider Professor of Law, and Director of the Penn Program on Documentaries and the Law. In January of this year, the program produced a video that explored the measures adopted by the Adult Social Services Unit of the Defender Association of Philadelphia to better serve clients caught up in the city's opioid crisis. The video is entitled Blended Practices, Public Defenders, Innovative Social Services, and Clients Struggling with Addiction. You can find it on the website of the Docs in the Law program and on Penn Law's YouTube channel. Five Penn Law students and a Penn undergraduate served as producers and directors on the project. Kurt Watkins, Chief of Adult Social Services, summed up the benefits of blended practices as follows.
This approach works. We're getting folks into treatment faster. We're getting folks help sooner. We're problem solving when they're having issues with programs and support. We're really giving the judges an idea of what it's like to walk in their shoes. That's really what I think everyone's idea of a fairer system is. Certainly, it's fiscally responsible because we're not spending money on putting people in jail. With more resources, with more innovation, with more leadership, more transformative leadership like this, we can do things beyond, you know, what I'm even imagining here.
At about the same time, the novel coronavirus was beginning its path of destruction across America. It has disrupted every aspect of our criminal justice system, from law enforcement and the courts to jails and prisons, probation officers, and parole officers. It has also altered the practice of indigent defense in Philadelphia and the delivery of social services that are a part of it. Our guests today are Kurt Watkins, Chief, and Nicole Buck, Assistant Chief of Adult Social Services for the Philly Defenders. They will discuss how they are responding to the crisis caused by COVID-19. On March 16, your offices closed, and soon thereafter, Governor Wolf ordered the complete shutdown of Pennsylvania. What was the immediate impact of the stay-at-home order on the work of the social services staff? How did it impact the unit's key operations, particularly regarding access to resources and information and response times?
Well, good morning, Ms. Austin. How are you? Thank you for having us both. We're very happy to be here and working with you again. COVID-19 had a devastating impact on our ability to provide services for our clients at the onset specifically. Our job, as you know, involves connecting defender clients to services and resources in the community to keep people out of jail or to help them transition back into the community safely, and to obviously help our attorneys advocate for better outcomes in court. In order to do all of that, we have to be able to interview our clients, have those resources to provide to them, and to have some time to create planning, reports, and so forth. When the stay-at-home order was issued by Governor Wolf, we obviously weren't able to provide any interviewing for our clients. We had very limited access to information. We had very little time to react. In addition, many of the community resources were shutting down as well, some due to the stay-at-home order and others due to fear. So it was at the very onset just disconcerting for us. We really measure ourselves by our resources, our information, and our time, and we had the least amount of all three at the onset. So it was really a scramble.
How were you able to maintain contact with clients or to compensate for your inability to do face-to-face interaction with clients, community partners, and importantly, each other?
Well, I'm going to let Nicole Buck, our Assistant Chief of Adult Social Services, take that. But what I'll say in the beginning is that we really had to regroup using technology. That was very important to us. Not every city agency has that ability or has that technology. So we were able to connect with our staff, regroup, and start to develop a strategy to deliver on some of the core values of our department. And we're going to discuss what those are. So, Nicole, do you want to say something about that question?
Yes. Good morning, Ms. Regina. Thank you again for having us this morning. Grateful to be connected virtually through this experience, the pandemic experience. I think what our office did well is on March 16th, we deployed staff to start contacting our partner agencies in the community and began a communication with them and a dialogue to see what their protocols were, how they were going to change in the wake of COVID, what the services would look like and how they could engage and interact with our clients. I think communication with our community, specifically the agencies and our provider partnerships, has been key to navigating this crisis. Educating the judicial partners as well about what that looks like, educating clients and making sure we are able to provide outreach services for our clients to make sure that they are educated on the new kind of norm, so to speak, in the COVID era, I think are all ways that we have responded to the crisis.
How did you communicate with your clients? That, I assume, was dependent upon their access to technology. What difficulties were there and how did you overcome them?
So what we did is we definitely communicated and partnered with our judicial partners in this process. And we were able to do telephone outreach with clients. We also contacted community partners and agencies that had, resources in the community that they were willing to engage with our clients that were re-entering the services. There was a depletion of housing through this pandemic due to the congregate settings. And what we did was we were able to lean on some of our partners who responded in that crisis situation. And because of them, we were able to get clients out. We were able to develop a kind of a quarantine protocol, and they were able to sign some leases in order to get clients out of custody and into the community with housing resources, programming resources, food resources. The amount of community that has come together has been very uplifting to watch. And those community partners contact us directly when there has been kind of a gap in whatever that service is. And we work collaboratively to problem solve those gaps with our clients.
Well, the social services workers in the unit are people who have families and responsibilities beyond what they do for a living. How would you characterize the unit's ability to handle this crisis situation as a unit and as individuals?
For me, I think that social workers and advocates, in our work, it is embedded the understanding and the accepting of change. We're taught that the only constant is change, and it is our job in this profession to help navigate that change. Social services specifically is the agent of change, and we are built in the capacity to be able to respond in crisis situations. I think that our strengths here have been problem solving and advocating and pivoting quickly to respond and provide support to our clients in our community. I think we're also kind of educators of resources, and we're still the voices for our clients in the courtroom and within programming and partnering and kind of dispelling the fear that may be there in terms of what it looks like to accept somebody from custody into an inpatient program, and kind of communicating and collaborating on how we can dispel some of that fear to work to get the client the level of care they may need in the community. To something as simple as what is the process in COVID to get an ID, a photo identification for some. So I really think that we responded and leaned on each other and kind of came up with a collaborative way with our attorneys for sort of out of the box solutions. And as Kurt would say, we've helped manage the fear amongst our judicial partners and our clients.
Lockups and jails are considered congregate settings. They have tight quarters, which provide limited opportunities for social distancing and personal hygiene, measures that prevent the spread of the virus. There was a real effort on the part of defense attorneys with the Defender Association, prisoner rights organizations, and others to get courts to reduce the number of persons in custody by releasing those charged with nonviolent offenses and those who are physically vulnerable. How do you blend the need for social services for released individuals with demands for release during a pandemic? What were your concerns as social workers, and how did those concerns compare to those of defense attorneys and social justice advocates?
Well, Regina, we didn't want folks to be victims of their rapid release. Okay. And in order to do that, we needed to help people have a custody release process that involved planning. We wanted to make sure that they were released, of course, attorneys do, social services, social workers do, but released safely and with the things that they need, including medications, treatment, resources, and as Nicole said, even housing. Folks were in sort of a frenzy and in a panic in the beginning stages. And we didn't want to put people in further jeopardy and perpetuate, you know, a cycle of desperation that led people to make bad choices in the community. So we needed to infuse planning into the custody release process, and we did that. What providers and resources were even open? We had to figure that out. This was not something that was commonly understood because, again, agencies were closing very rapidly. Some that were open in the morning were closed by the afternoon. Also, many people were released at the very beginning in the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic before we even had an opportunity to plan for them. So soon as we got ourselves together in a matter of a week, there were already a small portion of folks that had been released sort of an emergency situation. And we had to check on them and make sure that they were okay. So ultimately, we pivoted to making a real commitment to provide a plan for every defender client with an emergency release hearing and a focus on community outreach for every single client that was released. It was a massive, massive undertaking for our staff. Shifting the resources to outreach, calling clients, calling their families, connecting them to updated resources, giving them proper information, responsible information about, you know, how to deal with certain things, We did do it. So of over more than 1,300 people who were released, there were only a very small number of folks who were rearrested, clearly showing that we didn't need to rely on jails to keep communities safe, and that if you release folks responsibly, you could do it with planning and then with support once they get there and with problem solving once they connected to those folks via outreach.
It sounds to me as if your unit became a bridge between partners who do not ordinarily interact with each other, between partners and various elements of the criminal justice system, like the medical staff of the jails who could provide information about COVID-19, or between lawyers and clients as to the client's needs. Can you describe the role that members of the unit played in the proceedings that determined whether or not someone would be released? What role did the unit workers play in these hearings?
That's really what we do in a nutshell. We are, sort of a sort of centerpiece that interacts with various justice partner agencies for the benefit of our client.
Yes.
Really, I think, sort of had front stage, involvement with a pandemic and an emergency release like this, because we had to do it in a rapid amount of time and with all eyes on us, you know. And there was a lot of, inquiries coming from families, from clients themselves, mm-hmm. from, community partner agencies. Hey, are these people getting released? Where are they going? What are they doing? And so we had to explain what responsible planning looks like. And, the fact that folks had complicated legal matters and that they had complicated social situations or medical situations that needed, some attention. Some folks would ask us to, as judges, for example, to give people services or resources that just didn't exist. And we had to explain what the alternatives were.
Yes, Kurt, I completely, absolutely agree. And I think, sorry to jump in like this, but I think one of the points that you made me think that, at first, I think there was not an awareness amongst the judicial partners about this huge shift in resources, how outpatient was going to telehealth, how case managers were now working remotely, how there was literally a city shut down and kind of what those resources actually looked like and how they were functioning and operating. And I think what we were able to do when we were infused into the hearing process, the virtual hearing process, is we were able to educate the judicial partners, including, attorneys representing the judges, the district attorney, about what was available, how it was operating, how it was working. On 3/16, when this kind of shutdown happened, we began reaching out to about 40 different agencies to say, what is your protocol? What is your procedure? What is your telehealth number? How does it work? Are you still accepting sheriff drop-offs? That was inpatient treatment providers, outpatient treatment providers, housing providers. And on almost a daily basis for the first 3 weeks, there was a fluid process of change in their protocol and procedure. So we had a staff calling these providers daily. What that was able to do for us is that we were then educated on what it looked like to receive services for our clients. And so I think that definitely one of the advantages of collaborating and blending the practice in the COVID era was that we were able to answer some of the questions that the judges had. And lessen the fear, so to speak, of if I release this person, they're not going to have anything. What then? I think that there was more of a comfort in knowing, okay, we've already contacted, we know their funding is on, this is what telehealth looks like, we have a good contact number for community support. Once the client is out, we are going to do outreach and this is what this looks like. So we were able to dispel some of that fear through the process that we've developed. Pre-COVID era, we had already been doing that in kind of one-off situations or scenarios, or whenever clients may needed it, we were in court to advocate for them. And what we've seen is that now attached to a whole hearing list of 20-something clients, we're able to be active in the court proceeding for those clients and be available to engage in kind of whatever the question is to be able to have them successfully released with the supports they need.
Do you see a continuing role for social workers in court proceedings? Do you think that the practice under COVID-19 will have a lasting or long-term impact on your ability to represent your clients along with the legal defenders?
Absolutely. I believe that, one of the things we did, I want to just pull out a little bit here, is that that when hearings moved to Zoom, emergency release hearings moved to Zoom, we saw that as a really unique opportunity to infuse the legal process with the presence of a social worker. With 40 plus courtrooms, we obviously can't staff that many social workers to have a social worker in every court, although that's a dream that we have one day. But with hearings moving to remote, to Zoom, we have a unique opportunity to participate remotely in those hearings. So, and again, we have the opportunity to be vital, and we were. Many judges were not releasing clients without an understanding of what they were going to get, whether it was an emergency or not. So folks had to stay in jail until a plan was made. Case had to be relisted and the client, had to be heard on another day. So that was a delay in folks who could get out. Once we actually started participating on calls, there was real-time assistance. There was real-time information. And that education of sorts paid dividends throughout the system, because over a period of time, now the judges know, well, this is how that works. Well, this is how this works. And so we were really able to impact that. I see that as ongoing. I don't think COVID is going anywhere anytime soon. I think remote hearings are going to continue for a while in some form or fashion. And so I think that we're going to continue to play that role. And we've been very impactful by the feedback that we've gotten from that.
The future is important. And many of us are thinking about the future, whether it's the short term or this time next year, or until a vaccine is invented. How will the experience with COVID-19 affect your planning for the next round or for future pandemics? What skill set or training should social workers and social service advocates have going forward?
Well, number one, I think we need to shift from having a plan B to maybe having a plan C. We need to have a deeper understanding of what our core competencies are and be able to pivot to those in a crisis very quickly. I think, we need to maybe look at developing a better crisis response network in the city where agencies work together specifically to ensure rapid response, responsible and informed sharing of information occurs so that folks continue to be safe, get what they need in a crisis, and can move from custody, to out of custody situations and scenarios. Technology is needed too. And there's a huge technology divide that I think we've seen in Philly. And this goes beyond the justice system, obviously, to the schools and everything else. The technology divide, people lacking access to what's basic, Wi-Fi and internet. How are we expecting people to stay educated or connected to each other, competitive, or just informed without technology? And so if services move to telehealth and people don't have the ability to access them, what then?
And telephones.
And having telephones. They didn't even have telephones. And so our staff and the defender worked with other providers to get those to people so they could participate in telehealth. So, a broader response, technology included in that. And I think we also need to, of course, remember that this is personality driven work, as I said, and we may need to hire with a little bit more attention to, folks who are able to be problem solvers, able to be, less theoretical and more practical to some degree, persuasive, to get people to try things again or to try new things. Very persistent. So, it's going to have a large impact for us throughout our system. And, from hiring to technology, I think things are going to need to change, but we definitely need to work together to be more cohesive as a city.
My final question has to do with the concerns of academics and those of us who are engaged in higher education, particularly in the professional schools. We really want to know whether we will be able to provide opportunities for our students to interact with practitioners on the front lines, like both of you. You lost your interns when the universities and colleges in the area closed. Do you think that you will be able to provide clinical and internship opportunities for students in the fall? Can you envision a role for student interns in the world with COVID-19?
I'll start here, Kurt, if you don't mind. The way that I see it, the Defender, and I can speak specifically about the social services internship program, is really dedicated to investing in our upcoming clinicians, our upcoming advocates, and our upcoming social workers. I think that this is a very unique blend and field of study, and it brings both kind of the legal aspect of things and the clinical aspect of things, and it kind of merges those two fields into one practice. We are currently preparing for the fall, our fall cohort. It's a mix of undergrad and MSW graduate students. And what we're doing is we're exploring what the opportunities look like for students to engage in a world with COVID. What we're really focusing on is the importance of outreach opportunity and kind of helping facilitate, navigate, and advocate through the outreach process. And we're what I feel like we're doing for the students is potentially preparing them for a world where virtual interaction and telehealth may be embedded in our new norm. I think the beauty is that we are teaching students that change is the only constant embedded in this work, and it's the biggest lesson and teaching moment is how to adjust to change. We're helping them understand that. It's apparent, and change is the only thing that's just always going to be there.
We'll give you the last word, Kurt. Is there anything that you want to say to the residents of Philadelphia about what you've been doing during the pandemic to deal with issues around risk and fear?
Sure. What I can say is, you know, we're the public defender's office. People look at us as, you know, mostly attorneys. They look at us as being focused, you know, mainly on the legal aspect of their case. And it is true that to some extent, you know, attorneys are case specific to some extent. But we have legal team at the Defender Association that consists of social workers, social services advocates, mitigation specialists, and many, many others. And the team together, sharing and blending the specific, training of the different disciplines, makes a really, really powerful advocate and ally for the city of Philadelphia in terms of safety and for our clients, extending well beyond their legal charge. I just think that, you know, not enough attention is paid to the fact that there are many other people who are responsible for, caring for people within the legal system, helping them to leave custody and stay out of custody, stay progressive in the community, and advocating for them to have resources such as the technology that we spoke of and many, many others.
I want to thank you, Kurt, and thank you, Nicole, for sharing details about your very, very important work during the COVID-19 pandemic.